Welcome to the Accenture MIT podcast series. Here's Daniel Jackson, professor of computer science at MIT.
In this podcast, I'm going to talk about our first example of separation of concerns. It involves separating what Dijkstra called correctness from what he called desirability. Or as software engineers often put it, making a difference between building the program right and building the right program. You can build a program perfectly so that it has no bugs at all. But if it's not what the user wanted, and the user actually wanted a completely different program, it doesn't matter how perfect it is, it's still useless. Perfectly useless, we might say. A shockingly large number of developments fail because the wrong system is built. In 1995, the Standish Consultancy published the Chaos Report, a landmark study of software development failures. They collected project data from 365 companies on projects of all sizes and classified outcomes into successful projects, completed on time and on budget with the planned features, challenged projects, completed and operational but over budget, over time and missing features that had been originally specified, and failed projects, which were cancelled and therefore never deployed at all. Amazingly, the success rate was only 16%. 53% of projects were challenged and 31% failed. They estimated that the cost to companies and government agencies for the failed projects was about $81 billion in 1995 alone. In order to try and understand what makes a project a success or a failure, the Standish Group interviewed managers and asked them what they thought were the major factors for success and failure. The top-ranked factor for explaining why projects failed was incomplete requirements. Having a clear statement of requirements ranked third, after getting users involved and having support from executive management, in the factors for success. And the problem of requirements being incomplete and changing came second, again after lack of user input, in the factors causing projects to be challenged. This has now become common knowledge. If you want a project to fail, the easiest way to do it is to skimp on requirements. And if you want it to succeed, then after getting people in place, the most important thing you can do is to write a good requirements document. How do you do that? The requirements document achieves a separation of concerns by acting as a firewall between the users and the developers. From the user's perspective, the requirements document expresses their goals and wants. From the developer's perspective, the requirements document is the yardstick against which the developed system is to be measured. The separation of concerns is achieved because a programmer doesn't need to worry about whether the requirements actually reflect the user's goals. That's the analyst's job. And similarly, the analyst doesn't need to worry about the code being correct. That's the programmer's job. It's clear, then, that the requirements document, to be successful, has to serve two very different audiences. And that's a tricky thing to do. It's hard to get right, but easy to get wrong. The easiest way to get it wrong is to focus on the programmers at the expense of the users. By writing a requirements document that isn't really about requirements at all, it's just a description of a proposed solution to a problem that was never properly analyzed or documented. One flaw of such requirements is that they suffer from what's called implementation bias, which means that they, usually unconsciously, bias the developers towards a particular implementation, reducing the range of choices because implementation decisions have been inadvertently embedded in the requirements description. Here's an example I saw recently on a consulting project, modified slightly for confidentiality. The purpose of the system was to allow users to swap books with each other, and the requirements had to specify when one user's description of a book they wanted matched another user's description of a book they owned. The requirements writer did this by drawing a flowchart showing a series of checks being performed. This is a bad way to do things. First, it's operational rather than declarative. An operational specification gives a series of steps to perform. In this case, the individual checks to determine whether there was a match. Something like, First, compare the ISBNs of the books. If one or both is missing, go on to compare the author names. If the author names are missing, report a failure. Otherwise, go word by word through the title of the first description. If the word occurs in the title of the second description, increment the match count by one, and so on. A declarative specification just gives the criteria for the expected output. For example, you might say, two book descriptors match if their ISBNs match, or if they have missing ISBNs and the titles match exactly, or if they have missing ISBNs, the author names match exactly and the titles have at least three matching words, and so on. The operational specification is much harder to understand because you have to follow it through step by step, and you don't really know what's going on until you get to the end. Worse, it forces you into a particular way of implementing it. And in fact, on close examination, it became clear that in this case, the requirements writer actually had a particular database layout and SQL queries in mind. So if you change the database layout, the flowchart would no longer apply. This is one of the reasons that the computer scientist David Grease called flowcharts flaw charts, because they're a deeply flawed way of specifying things. And for describing an execution itself, it's better to use a real programming language. In practice, there's a bigger problem in making the requirements document more driven by the needs of the developers than the users. By focusing attention on the developers, it's easy to ignore the concerns of the users and lose track of the most important thing, the purpose of the system, why it's being built at all. There was a fascinating study reported in a 2009 paper by Tetsuo Tamai from the University of Tokyo and Mayumi Itakura Kamata from IBM Research. They took 32 projects developed by a large company in Tokyo and examined their requirements documents. For each project, they recorded how much effort was spent on different aspects of the requirements, and then they compared this to how the project fared in terms of cost and time overruns. It turned out that how much detail was given in the section describing system functions was a good predictor of whether the project would come in on time and on budget, or would overrun. But surprisingly, the correlation was negative. The more the requirements writers said about the intended functions, the more likely the project was to fail. In some respects, therefore, separation of concerns turns out, contrary, I think, to what Dijkstra thought, not to be the primary issue here. It is indeed important to separate the concerns of the users from the concerns of the developers, and a specification can act to bridge those concerns. But in practice, users can't evaluate a specification because they're often not really sure what functions they need. And developers, if they only write a specification, can easily miss what the users really want. So it turns out that two separate documents are needed: a requirements document that describes the goals of the system, and a specification document that describes in detail how it will behave. To some, requirements are just vague specifications. But to be useful, requirements have to be different from specifications. The clearest distinction between requirements and specifications that I know of is made by Michael Jackson in his book Software Requirements and Specifications. The key distinction that he makes is that a specification of a software system describes how it behaves at its interface. But a requirements, in contrast, describes the effect the software system will have in the world. For example, a specification of a traffic light system may say that the lights should show red, then yellow, then green, and so on, with particular timings, and that lights at successive intersections on a long road should be synchronized, and so on. The requirements, on the other hand, would say that the system should prevent collisions, ensure smooth flow of traffic, good utilization of roads, and so on and so forth. It's important to understand that usually the software alone can't make the requirements hold. If a driver ignores a red light, for example, there's nothing the software can do to prevent a collision. The job of the requirements analyst is therefore to record not only the overall requirements, such as preventing collisions, but also the assumptions about the problem domain. For example, that drivers obey traffic signals, Then whoever comes up with the specification has to make an argument that the software, if it satisfies its specification, will, in combination with the domain assumptions, ensure the requirements. Documenting domain assumptions may seem to be a pedantic exercise. Aren't they always obvious? Well, it turns out that they're almost never obvious. And when an assumption seems to be obvious, it's usually wrong. It's amazing how often failed domain assumptions are responsible for software-related accidents. A classic example is the crash of an Airbus in Warsaw in 1993. When it came into land, there was a strong crosswind and heavy rain, so the pilot increased his speed. On touchdown, the aircraft aquaplaned on a thin film of water. Because the wheels weren't in contact with the ground, braking didn't help, so the pilot tried to activate reverse thrust. Unfortunately, it was disabled by a software override, and the plane careened off the runway, killing the pilot and a passenger. It turned out that the designers of the software controller had made an assumption that if wheel pulses were not being generated by a rotating wheel, the plane must be in the air. Because the aircraft was aquaplaning, the wheels were not turning, and no wheel pulses were generated. This domain assumption was therefore untrue, and as a result, even though the software met its specifications, the system as a whole failed disastrously. Peter Ladkin's research group at the University of Bielefeld has organized an extensive collection of reports and analyses of aviation accidents, including this one. If you go there, you can find a more comprehensive explanation of what happened. Incorrect domain assumptions are rife. The Ariane 5 rocket failed in large part because an assumption about lateral acceleration, which was true for an earlier rocket, turned out to be false for the Ariane 5. A Mars Polar Lander crashed because an assumption about the amount of vibration a leg should expect was wrong, and the craft interpreted a small jolt as evidence that it had landed on the surface of Mars, when in fact it was still in space. Domain assumptions play a big role in enterprise information systems too. That's why Accenture development teams put so much work into what's called as-is business processes, because if you don't know how a company runs its business, you won't be able to build software to support it. In summary then, there is a fundamental separation of concerns between validation and verification, or in Dijkstra's words, between desirability and correctness. And a specification is the key to achieving that separation. But making a clean separation is only part of your job as a software developer. The harder part, in this case at least, is documenting what the user really wants. And that demands paying attention to requirements and understanding how a requirements document and a specification are really two very different things.
Copyright 2010, Daniel Jackson. Music copyright 2010, Chris Bremer from pianosociety.com.